This is Haunted America with your host, Josh Mantello, and Al Shepard on Blog Talk Radio. To discuss today's topics, call 646-716-5896. And now, Haunted America with Josh Mantello and Al Shepard.
Thank you, Mr. Dave Nutter. This is Haunted America Radio. My name is Al Shepard, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Josh Mantello. Hello, Josh.
Hello, Al, and welcome back, everybody who's listening.
We've got a big show today. Today is the anniversary of the shooting death of Wild Bill Hickok. So we've got a Wild West theme show. We've got two guests that are going to be on in just a few minutes from Deadwood, South Dakota. It's going to be a great show. But before we get to that, Josh did a little bit of ghost hunting at the Houghton Mansion the other night, invited me down. My daughter and I went down with our EVP recorder and our K2 meter, and actually got a few things that I wanted to run by you, Josh.
Oh, that's great. We had a pretty good night that night, it sounds like.
Here's one on the Frank's box. I don't know what it's saying, but to me it sounds like it's saying something. So maybe you can see what you think here.
Where are you seated right now?
Boy, that didn't sound... That's hard to hear on this thing. Let's try it again.
Yeah, I just heard my own voice.
Yeah, well, right after that, there's something there. I might have to email you these MP3s so you can hear them. But right after you, I hear something.
Where are you seated right now?
See, you can hear something there, but I don't know what. So
there's a bang in there. I don't really hear any voices. It could just be the way it's being transmitted to me, you know, the file gotten.
I'll email you the whole MP3. You can hear it a lot better. Here's the second one, another one that I had. Now, there's something right after you, and I don't remember anyone else in the room talking, so I'm not sure. So let me work down the list here. I've got, do you remember anybody singing there that night? Because I seem to have caught somebody singing here.
No,
sounds
I
like
can't.
To me.
I don't usually walk around singing. I don't know. I don't remember anybody singing off the top of my head.
You can hear I'm walking up the stairs, but in the background, very faintly. Like I said, I'm gonna have. Well, let me boost this up to 400 and see what that helps any here. You hear that in the background?
Yeah, very faintly. I did hear something. At this point, yeah, it's kind of tough to make out. Even with my headset on right now, I hear a lot of the background noise. But I could hear. You say you heard you singing. I heard a voice.
It's not really singing, but it's someone saying something. But it's with a more melodious type voice, you know, like sometimes spirits do, you know. So, I'll have to email these to you. Here's one with another one to you on the Frank's box, asking it, the spirit, I believe you're asking it how long it had been there.
How long has it been since you passed?
Thank you.
Spirit are in the building with you.
Well, to me, it sounds like coming through the Frank's box, he's repeating what you said. He's saying, how long back do you? And did it twice, even though the second question was different. It sounded to me like he was still repeating the first question. Let me try one more time.
How long has it been since you passed?
Open to interpretation, but it sounded to me like he was saying how long right back to you.
It did. I have to kind of disagree though. It coming over the box, that almost sounds like it's a more of a regular EVP than something that would normally come out of the hack box there.
Okay. Well, I got a couple more here, and what I'll do is I'll make sure I send you all these MP3s. You can listen to them yourself, pick them apart through the next week, and maybe we can discuss them in more detail next week. I'm thinking of it next week. We're going to have Paul Rademacher. Yeah, I can never pronounce his name. Rademacher, the executive director of the Monroe Institute, will be here next week at 7:30. So we'll have a full half an hour to get into these next week. Maybe. You can clean them up or do something with them.
I'll put them through my software and see what I can do with them. Sometimes EVPs are a creature of themselves in paranormal investigating, and I never really believed people when they used to tell me this. You know, that it really takes a while to train your ears what to listen for with these EVPs. I was kind of like, if it's there, it's there. And it really is true. You do have to kind of train your ear and yourself on how to listen to and for these stray voices in the recordings, especially when it comes to, the ones that are your Class B and C EVPs that are weaker and harder to find and hear.
Yeah, these didn't really sound that weak, when you've got them right on your local machine, but something's getting lost in the translation here. Here's another one. I'll just play it, see what you hear.
Do you like the company that we bring to the building?
To me, it sounded like you were getting an answer right after you finished your question. Let me try.
I heard.
Do you like the company that we bring to the building?
It's a lot clearer sounding no when you play it on your own computer. All right, the next one, the last one I've got it in three. I broke it up into three different categories here. I've got the original long version, then I shortened up just the what I wanted you to hear, and then I that part and slowed it down. So you can understand it a little bit better, because we're having a little bit of trouble here. So let me play the original version. This is me just outside of Mary's room. And that wasn't me. So let me shorten it up here. Let me try it again.
Yeah, I'm definitely hearing something in there. EVPs, a lot of them, you got to listen to them repeatedly to really start trying to pick out what it's saying. So,
well, here, I slowed it down. I slowed it down. It might be a little bit easier for you here. Try it again.
That almost sounded like a help. That almost sounded like it said, help me.
Well, my daughter and I, and my wife, all three of us listened to it, and what we came up with is, he was afraid. So with that in mind, let me try it again.
All right, I hear two separate, almost two separate voices. There's a very deep, and then kind of the afraid was a higher pitch sound to it.
Yeah. When you listen to it, I'll send you the EVPs or the MP3s. It sounds more like just one young girl's voice. So I'll send them to you, and you can.
Because I did kind of hear almost the afraid in that younger girl's voice. And for those who were listening last week, no, this wasn't one of the times when I had my two young daughters with us there either. So I know somebody would have to bring that up. But no, they weren't. They weren't there, so there were no younger girls present that night.
If you got about 5 minutes of something you want to cover with the audience, you can go ahead, and I'll jump out of here and go see if I can connect with our guests.
Oh boy, if I. Put me on the spot now. 5 minutes of things to cover with our guests.
Oh, sure. If I don't mention it, you'll talk for 30 minutes anyway, but just because I tell you to.
Okay. Hey,
discuss EVPs in general, since we just made them.
Yeah, that's what I was just thinking. I would throw out some EVP discussion there. those EVPs, those are really good. Those are real raw. You got to have to kind of remember that when you're, especially the first time you're hearing EVPs, and especially these ones, you kind of have to take into consideration the avenues they're taking to get to where we are, especially using the internet radio. For me, I'm called in into a switchboard, which is, or I'm calling into a phone number in New York somewhere, which is then hooked into a switchboard of Al in Vermont, which is dialed in, and he uploaded it and played it there. And they've taken a while, and especially with these digital format files, a lot of times things can get distorted as they go. It's tough. EVPs, I know personally myself, when I get to sit down and listen to my recordings, you really need to sit down in a nice quiet area with those nice big oversized comfortable headphones and shut yourself off from, the rest of the area around you and listen very intensely to try and figure out if there's anything there, then what is there. You need to kind of go back and forth on it. A lot of your softwares now that people are picking up to run their EVPs through has an option where you can highlight the section where you can get the EVP, highlight the section where the EVP is and put it into a loop, slow it down a little bit, try and, maybe get rid of some of your background noises and stuff like that. So it can be a little discouraging hearing something for the first time. For anybody, right over, a radio or something like this, it's a little bit tougher, especially with the ones that aren't your big Class A, better Class B EVPs. But kind of like also another thing, I said, is it does take a really good trained ear to get used to working with EVPs. And learn how to even find them and hear them. I remember when I first got into the field, there was somebody I spoke with a lot about EVP who was a is considered a pretty much an expert in the field, and is a member of AAEVP, and actually did some work on the movie White Noise, which is based on EVPs. One thing she kind of had taught me was start listening for different kind of hisses, clicks, and pops inside your recording. They say that's kind of a hint or a clue that the spirit has kind of, I guess for the lack of better words, entered your machine or is around it. So those clicks and pops are, you know, the electronics inside the machine starting to, you know, get manipulated in a way, in a form, you know, when the spirit enters it. And then now when you start hearing those within a few seconds afterwards, you will actually supposedly supposed to start hearing the voices coming through, and then at that point, you know, you capture it, you try to loop it and figure out what it's saying, you know, go back, listen to what you asked for a question, you know, and try and think if what you're getting back is somewhat of a logical answer or just some sort of garbage that's coming back over the air. Other than that, you know, a lot of people will ask a lot of times about what a good software to use to come over your EVPs. There's about a million different softwares. You can probably pick up anything from, you can pick up the high-end stuff using Audacity, or I'm sorry, not Audacity. You can get the Adobe Suite stuff. That stuff can cost you up into the several hundreds of dollars. I usually recommend for people starting out into the field and they want to learn how to work EVPs, but they don't want an overly complicated program, but one that still has the ability to clean things up and fix the EVPs and the audio files a little bit, I recommend that you go online and get what's called Audacity. Audacity is a free download over the internet. You're able to upload and record your audio files right onto your computer from that. And it has the ability to capture segments of the audio file, watch it in a wave format. It has noise filters, high-end filters, low-end filters. It allows you to do repeats, repeat back and forth, slow down. All the features, you know, most of your real expensive softwares have, this will have with it, and you'd be surprised. I mean, it has a little bit of a learning curve, like any program has, but once you kind of get the hang of it, you mess around with it a little bit, and you go from there. Hopefully, Al has our guest coming up on the other line. I'm running out of things to talk about here in my five-minute stint. I'll throw out the number here to call in if anything that we're talking about tonight interests you as we go. Last week we had three people call in. Let's see if we can match that number this week. But feel free to call in. The number is, oh my God, I lost the number. Where'd it go? I had it right in front of me. The number is 646-716-5896. And again, we're going to be kind of having a Wild West.
Hello.
Here we are.
With the usual blog talk problems, but we are now connected. So, are you ready for me and our guests here?
Absolutely. I've been ready for a week.
Okay. I was gonna give them this great big introduction, but the more I got reading on these people, that it would take me the whole show just to introduce them. So, what I'm going to do is I'm going to let them introduce themselves. So, David or Kathleen, I want to thank you for being here with us. And whoever wants to go first, I'm going to let you guys introduce yourself because you've got so many different titles and things going on that I wouldn't know where to start. So, hello? Where the heck are they? They were on a minute ago. Wait a minute.
Uh-oh.
Blog Talk's acting up tonight here. My screen's just going crazy.
Can you hear me, Alan?
I can hear you now. There, I got you both now.
Okay.
Blog Talk's screwing up tonight. There. All right, so whoever wants to go first, introduce yourself.
Alan, this is David Soma, and I'm talking to you from high above Main Street of Deadwood, Dakota Territory, in the old Fairmont Hotel on the corner of Wall Street and Main Street of Deadwood. And you may hear a rumble outside because we're in the middle of our Steel Horse Rendezvous here in the Black Hills, sometimes known as the Sturgis Motorcycle Rally.
Oh, that's
we've got a lot of those modern day cowboys out there on the street riding their steel horses up and down. So I'd like to welcome your worldwide radio web audience to Deadwood, Dakota Territory, on the 133rd anniversary of the assassination of James Butler Hickok here in Deadwood, and on August 2nd, 1876. And with me this evening is Kathleen Lane. She and I and others are members of the Lone Stars of Deadwood. We are living history reenactors, performers, actors, and entertainers. And Kathleen is Deadwood's legendary clairvoyant here in Deadwood.
Hello, everyone. Kathleen Lane here. And we are sitting here sweltering on the third floor of the occupied, other than by the live folks here at the Fairmont Hotel, looking down on thousands of motorcycles. We have a lot of company up here also, but they're not visible to most people. But I don't know, perhaps they will come in at some point, noises, things falling down off of tables, etc. We would like to be available for questions or to let Alan kind of guide this and tell us what you would like to hear.
Well, first I want to introduce you both to my co-host Josh Mantello, and I'm sure he'll come up with a whole bunch of questions for you as well as I
know. I'm sure as we get into this, I'm sure it'll all start popping into my head, all the questions.
We love questions.
We answer questions all the time here on the street and all over Deadwood and throughout the West, where we've been performing, and we have traveled extensively all the way from Tombstone down in Cochise County in Arizona up to Deadwood here in Dakota Territory. So it's wide open for your audience.
I just pulled up a picture of that, of your building there online. Beautiful. Beautiful looking building there.
Yeah, it's the old Fairmont, right across the street from the Bullock Hotel. The Bullock Hotel is the oldest hotel in Deadwood, built in 1895, and it is a haunted hotel, one of the top 10 haunted hotels in the country. And there are occurrences in there on a daily basis, either with the staff, some of which we may have a chance to visit with later in the program this evening. And they conduct a daily ghost tour every evening in that hotel, and it's actively subscribed to by we get over 1.5 million visitors a year here in Deadwood, and many of them, their one stop is the ghost tours at the Bullock Hotel.
Now, have you found that the paranormal or the hauntings of the area has created kind of its own tourist draw? I know Gettysburg, you know, which is well known for its battlefields and the history. Now, when you go there, it almost seems like every corner you go on has a haunted tour, especially with that, you know, Gettysburg being, you know, known as one of the most haunted places in the world. Have you seen now almost a tourist base in that area, just for the hauntings and that side of it?
It's an interesting question. I would think that would be the case. But there is kind of a prejudice against that around here, in that we feel that what you see is what you get. However, even though we are the only game in town in terms of haunted tours or paranormal activities, except for on Halloween, where a few of the properties will open up to haunted tours, we find that there is a growing interest, and whenever you walk up to a local and you get to know them a bit or her a bit, push just a little bit in the right way, and you'll get a story about the people who occupy their home, their workplace, their church, where they go to the gym, etc. And the folks who are coming here, the biker rally, for instance, they could care less about goats. They want to buy T-shirts, and they want to get drunk. But
yeah.
Our general tourist group seems to be more and more interested in the paranormal. And Paranormal States on A&E Cable will be filming our ghost tour on the third weekend of September to air sometime this coming season, 09-10.
Right. And I think just from my own experiences with TV, I think you'll see that your base will actually grow. And you'll probably get a lot more people. Expect a lot more extra phone calls and emails. I kind of run a haunted building with haunted tours up here in Massachusetts, and it was featured on the Travel Channel show, which is called Ghost Adventures. And I don't go a week now where somebody doesn't come into town, they've seen it on TV, and now they want to visit it. It's become a tourist destination in itself. Well, that's the place we saw on TV. And I, you know, phone calls and people wanting to jump in with tours. I was just curious because, you know, I've seen it here, paranormal tourists.
We have experienced here with the Bullock Hotel that there are more and more people that are coming to Deadwood to stay specifically at that hotel, participate in the ghost tour. And in the last couple of years, that kind of business base, occupancy base at the hotel has increased and become a major marketing part for them. People are seeking it out now, and it's interesting because they're finding it up here in Deadwood at this old hotel. So I'm sure that there are other places around the country that are doing the same.
Well, there are many. I can, just off the top of my head, I mean, I'm out here in New England. And, you know, there's a handful right out here, you know, old colonial and revolutionary war stops, you know,
right.
Hotels. And we got one up in Vermont that, you know, that's approaching me because they're looking for money and they've always been known to be haunted but never really wanted to exploit it. And now that they're looking for a little bit of extra cash, they want to do something with it. And they approached me and, you know, Abe Lincoln and his family are set to haunt there from time to time and they want to get in on it. You know, a lot of these places in the hard times are looking for the alternative means to try and bring in people, you know, fans. And it's good for us, for the fans of the ghosts, the fans of the paranormal. You know, it's making it easier for us to go out and have these kind of haunted getaways where 10 years ago you probably couldn't have done that.
Well, Unsolved Mysteries was here in Deadwood and did a very famous and well-researched and well-observed and witnessed half-an-hour show on the Bullock Hotel. The tours at the Bullock have been going on and off since then, mostly on since about 92, after the big renovation when gambling was legalized again in 1989. Also, we've had Fox, PBS, lots of local stations, meaning in the five-state area. I think one of the reasons that the tour does well is not because we're exploiting it necessarily because of the recession or whatever other hard luck story. It's because if you come to the Bullock Hotel, either as a private citizen with no equipment, even perhaps a camera, or if you come here as a very well-equipped paranormal radio station out of Colorado, you're going to get results. You're
right.
Going to have an experience. You're not going to just get a tour and see a costumed reenactor. You are going to get a paranormal experience. 99% of the tours that we conduct, there is a paranormal experience. All of the TV stations come to us at Halloween because they know that there will be results on their television camera for the viewer in his armchair at home that they can see. It's not just stories. It's actual results.
Yeah, and that's so hard to do. I mean, just for my own interest in the building I run that's haunted, and I can't give those results. I can't say every tour I've done has some sort of experience. My tours run about 2 hours long, and maybe 30% of them will have some sort of experience. I do sleepovers in the building those usually will have experiences. Actually, Al was there Thursday night and captured some EVPs with us. But that's great. I always like to adequate haunted tours of buildings as kind of like a whale watch. You know, you can never guarantee that a whale shows up in the ocean on a whale watch. I can never guarantee that a ghost will show up on a ghost tour. But that's amazing that, you know, you can get that much activity.
In the last week, on the tours over at the Bullock Hotel, there have been reports of children playing in the hallways in the middle of the night, and there were no children there. There have been two reports of hearing music playing, and Mrs. Bullock, her and her husband Seth built that hotel, was an accomplished musician and singer. There was an image in one of the mirrors that came through of a Native American that was probably one of the most clear reflections in a mirror image that I have seen in many years. There is always an A, the letter A, in one of the mirrors that shows up. Never shows up in the same spot, but it shows up irregularly in the same mirror. That's just in the last week. And these were experiences either by guests staying at the hotel who went down and inquired at the front desk, or by people who were taking the ghost tour, and they reported to the tour director and whatnot that, well, what about this? I heard this, or I smelled this, or I saw this. And that's just in the last week. It's a very active time here in Deadwood. Over the years that we've been doing it, we have found that this time of the year is a very active time of the year. So, as Kathleen was saying, it is. We can't guarantee it, but almost on every single one of the tours, on a nightly basis, somebody on that tour is going to experience something.
Josh, I have a question. When you do a tour, are you a psychic, or do you have an empath or a sensitive with you? Because that increases your results by, I find, about 90%.
No, generally. I like to throw this out like I always kind of do. I pretty much have the psychic ability of a rock. So, and I'm the one
okay.
I generally do the tours. So,
mm-hmm.
I'm just kind of going off the luck of something happening. And I do agree with you. You know, having someone of with psychic ability or an empathic being able to increase your ability to get something to come out. I've always kind of fell under the theory that psychics, empaths, people with that gift act almost as a lighthouse to spirits, and that, you know, a spirit can see that they have the ability to communicate, and they'll actually be more attracted and more, you know, more apt to come out because they know somebody's there that can understand and communicate with them. So I can definitely see where having someone with that ability available to do tours on a regular basis would actually help a lot.
Do you know how to get into that physical manifestation that allows it to enter? Really, I think anyone with a little bit of practice and focus and training can do it. It is a physical change that one goes through in order to be an open, clear channel. It requires a lowering of the respiration, breathing, blood pressure, temperature, and then one goes into a different mode. I would say it would be a delta wave. You change your electromagnetic frequency because it is a communication of two ways. Think of the Christian cross, which actually preceded the Christian religion, as a symbol. It was a symbol of the intersection of the two worlds. The world that is right by you, the world that is unseen to most people, is vibrating at a higher frequency. They must lower their frequency. You must raise your frequency, lower your body processes, and then the clear channel is established. It's not brain surgery. It's all electromagnetics and focus.
I have heard all that. I've tried, and, you know, there's a few moments where I think I've gotten into that, started getting into that rhythm. I don't know if I scare myself out of it or why. I have practiced it. I don't know. I've tried. That's the best way I can really say it.
It helps, and it takes a while, and then when you got it, you know it.
Right.
It's like you've learned to play pool. You're in the zone, whether you're playing tic-tac-toe or what. You know when you're there because you're clear and you can feel it. I can change the temperature of the room within a six-foot radius of myself. It can go up. It can go down. I can feel it tingling at the ends of my fingers, especially notice the first joint to the tip of your left index finger, which is your yin, feminine, or receptive side. It starts to come in there, goes up your finger, up your hand, up your arm, and throughout your whole body until you have what is essentially a kundalini rush from the base of the spine up the spinal column and out the top of the head, and you're there.
Yeah, that's great. That's amazing, though. Someday I'll keep practicing and say I have some better abilities, I think.
Well, we're going to hook you right up next week's show there with...
That's right.
Next week we have the Paul, what's his name, Rademacher or whatever. I can never say his name. Executive Director of the Monroe Institute and makers of HemiSync. And we're going to bring him on for an hour and a half, and he's going to show all us people that have the psychic ability of a rock how to increase our abilities.
Oh, good. Uh-oh. That sounds wonderful.
I'm looking forward to that one, too. These next 2 weeks are the 2 weeks I've really been looking forward to. A couple questions that came into my mind while we were talking there a few minutes ago. One, I kind of wanted to bring up the point that, you know, Deadwood is obviously, you know, a very historical, you know, town. You know, is very rich in history. And I think anybody who's a really good and strong paranormal investigator has to be somewhat of a mild historian and have a very good, you know, backing in history and a like of history. Have you seen that? A lot of people coming in, you know, they're big history buffs, but they're also kind of getting into the ghost thing now. They're actually kind of starting to interweave the ghosts and in history.
I find that many of the people that come, they have an armchair understanding of the American West kind of history. They know about Deadwood. They know about Wild Bill Hickok. And that's about it. They kind of just scratch the surface. What we try to do with them is to suspend their reality in a living history sense and take them back to a time of 1876. Many of the times, many shows that I do, I say that, you know, you may think this is August 2009. But for the next hour or so, I'm going to take you on a journey through time and place. And the time will be 1876. And the place will be Deadwood Gulch, Dakota Territory. This that we are in is Lakota country. The Lakota, the Native Americans. I think in the, you know, to get to delve deep into your question, you have to go here into the very lengthy native cultures that have been in and out of the Black Hills of Dakota for centuries. They could be traced all the way back to the Clovis Point traders that came through this part of the continent. The Lakota, or as they are commonly known as the Sioux, they've only been here for several centuries. But before them were the Crow and the Blackfeet, and before them the Arikaras. And in all those native cultures, they felt that these Black Hills, this Pa'asafa, as the Lakota call it, was a very spiritual place, a very powerful place. And it is. There's no getting around that. The natives who traveled in this part of the world, they never lived in these Black Hills, even though if you know the location around us is this barren prairie for hundreds and hundreds of miles.
Yeah.
This is a high-altitude, forested, mountainous area. They would not live up here. It was too powerful. They would come into this area for their special ceremonies for births and for deaths and burials, but they felt that living here was just way too much for them. They, many of my friends among the Lakota now, they kind of question sometimes, why in the world are all these white people living there? How can they do that? And I have to agree with them sometimes when you go through one of our winters or our springs here, because the weather is not conducive to human habitation. But these Black Hills, where we are talking to you from this evening, this is some of the oldest rock on the planet Earth. These rocks are 70 to 100 million years old. The Black Hills originally, we believe, was one volcano that was over 100 miles long and about 60 miles wide and more than 15,000 feet high. The volcano never erupted. All the activity was underground here. And we had two vents, one being Bear Butte on our eastern edge and the other being Devil's
right.
Tower on our western edge.
Yeah.
But these mountains are granite and quartz and crystals, and it is a powerful, powerful place.
Yeah, that was a question I was going to try. I was going to ask you was, you know, what they were composed of. There's a lot of people who feel, you know, and for an area to be very energized and more spiritual than others is basically what's in the ground. And is there limestone? Is that a large limestone area?
Yes, we have a lot of limestone, a lot of schist, quartz, and of course the two greatest conductors of energy on the planet. Lots of water and lots of gold.
Yeah,
the water table under where we are now is 6 inches below the floor of the basement. When we start getting the spring rains and the floods of the melting, the snow, the water is up to sometimes ankle deep and above in the basements of the properties. And when that is the case, the folks who come through the ghost tours don't even need cameras. The people walk right by and you get a picture of a satin dress flying by on the camera. And then the people on the floor above come running down and say, we just saw a woman in a red satin dress float by. Anybody know anything about that? And they look at the camera that the person took the picture of on the second floor, and basically they freak out.
Yeah.
So
that's a lot to see when you're just on a tour.
Yes, there's a lot to see, and we also have to keep in mind that the electromagnetic energy around this place is at least what it was around the whole globe 1,000 years ago. There has been a diminution by 50% of the electromagnetic pressure around the globe, which means that people no longer communicate with plants, animals, and spirits the way we used to. But here in the Black Hills, that's not the case because the electromagnetics are in some of the rooms up to 32 times normal. People bring in the machines. I don't need the machines. I just need to be barefoot, have a glass of water, and been to the bathroom. That's all I find that I need to get the same results that they're getting on the monitors around me. But the pressure that's here, the tension that is here, is what the Lakota and the people before them believed would hold your spirit here forever. And if you died here or if you were born here, your spirit could never journey to be with those other folks, both descendants and ancestors. This is a place where the time-space continuum has a few warps, which is why I find it so absolutely fascinating. You can be sitting somewhere, all of a sudden everything changes around you, your ears block up, you can't see sometimes, and all of a sudden the lights show from very close to you, but a vibrational essence above you comes right in front of you, just like a film when it flickers on the screen. It's fascinating.
That is amazing. And, you know, that's something that you hear a lot with some of your most famous hauntings is...
Yes, yes.
Is the ground that they're upon. Probably one of the most famous hauntings in America is the Stanley Hotel out in Colorado.
Oh, I get a lot of those people, yes. I've had the pleasure of taking the night security guard, the woman who does it all alone in the winter. I've taken her through my ghost tour. She's a lot of fun. She's one of my favorites.
And, you know, and that's in the mountains on a limestone deposit out here where
right.
I am. And out here where I am in northwestern Massachusetts, we have a large marble quarry not marble, I'm sorry, limestone quarry with, actually with some quartz in these mountains and marble, and some of the most amazing hauntings in this area are out here in the Berkshire Hills. A lot of people really feel that, you know, these spirits, maybe not just for the shock of their passing, and, you know, people think, oh, a spirit can't pass on because of, you know, its own reasons. Maybe there's something actually physical in the earth that's keeping them behind a little bit more, and more apt to be staying in that area. And that, you know, that area, you're saying you got the gold, the quartz, the limestone, you know, all these high energy, high frequency stones and minerals and crystals. No wonder there's hauntings all over the place.
Well, you have to distinguish between hauntings, too, and spiritual imprints, where something that happened a day, a week, a year, a century ago is still kind of playing on there, and that's not a full haunting. But
right, yeah, I mean, yeah, that's, you know, your differences, you know, intelligent hauntings and residual stuff. And either or, I can see where both would be so much more apt to happen in an area that's so much more energized. Like Joe's Hill.
Well, and you mentioned the limestone quarry that's there near you. Here, you must imagine that the gulch where Deadwood is here in the northern hills, it has been gouged out. Gold mining has been taking place here for 133 years. The richest gold mine in the North America, it was located right here.
Western Hemisphere.
And that mine goes down over 9,000 feet down into the mountain here. And the tunnel system that goes out from there, the drifts that they've built out, some of them are 3 to 5 miles long.
Wow.
There's been a lot of gouging out. I mean, they've taken out of that one mountain, just one mountain, over 40 million ounces of gold. That's a lot of gold to be coming out of one mountain. And there's been a lot of gouging going on here, a lot of turmoil in this old rock. And that has been stirring it up, I believe, over now a century and a third almost.
Right, and that, absolutely. I would imagine, especially if some of this ground is, and you said, you know, the lands go back, you know, hundreds of years, you know, thousands of generations, and, you know, and the natives, you know, that. Mm-hmm. You can only imagine and try to understand the tragedy, the love, the everything that's ever happened on that ground. You know, there's imprints of, you know, thousands of generations that happened there. It's hard to even understand.
And it's interesting because sometimes you can hear them, you can see them, you can feel them. It is so real. I know Kathleen can do it. And can feel it. And growing up in this area as I have over the years, I have experienced it. You know, it's we were talking about the natives and one of the legends or one of the myths that we have here in the Black Hills is that this is where great Lakota leader Crazy Horse, he was born here in these Black Hills someplace. Location is not known, but recent information is that it is here in the Black Hills. He is probably buried here in the Black Hills someplace. We don't know where. But it's interesting that just 45 miles south of us here on a chunk of granite that will be there for thousands of years, they are carving the Crazy Horse Monument down there, which is larger than Mount Rushmore, which is about 10 miles away from it. It is a complete 360-degree Native American composite of many of the Native leaders in the North American continent and his horse. It's a marvelous piece of art. But Crazy Horse is, and it's not going to be finished in my lifetime. Maybe the next generation, they may complete it. But that is a kind of a knock-knock world that Crazy Horse was born here, and Crazy Horse will be in these Black Hills that he worshipped and he loved, and he took his spirit from here for generations and generations to come. And that's very important, very moving here in these Black Hills.
Oh, I would imagine.
And I I can recommend to anyone to go to YouTube, do a search on the laser light show that they do over there at the Crazy Horse.
Oh, that's beautiful, yes.
Unbelievable. Yeah, it is. Just reading, seeing that Josh is a Mason and that the Houghton Mansion that he gives the ghost tours at is a Masonic temple, how about telling us about the Masonic connections there with Deadwood? I know I found an article on that on the internet, and I believe it had your name all over it, David.
Yes. We've had a very active Masonic lodge here in Deadwood since the 1890s. As a matter of fact, the house that we live in was completed in the late 1880s, and the very first Masonic lodge meeting took place in that house. Deadwood is located in one of the triangles of Masonicness, with Bear Butte and Devil's Tower and Slim Buttes just to our north on these hills. If you look at it from the other angle, it is a perfect triangle going back down. The main street of Deadwood is laid out along those lines. The cemetery here, Mount Moriah, is laid out in a Masonic as a Masonic cemetery. And just as Washington, D.C. and our nation's capital is laid out in many Masonic patterns, Deadwood, in its own way, both naturally and man-made, is laid out in that same way. And we had a lot of fun working with the writer, the author of that series. He did quite a series on it. And we were able to visit with him because he's a Masonic historian about the parallel universes and about the gravitational pulls here. And I'm glad to hear that it's on the internet now, because it appeared here just on a local, some 30,000 circulation magazines. But there is a strong influence of the Masonicness here in the Black Hills. They're still active here today. As a matter of fact, at the Masonic Lodge and the theater there that they have in the old lodge building is where they conduct the trial of Jack McCall every night, the assassin of Wild Bill Hickok. During the summer. And it's a beautiful, beautiful lodge building that we have here on Main Street.
And the article also mentions that you went and spent the night at Wild Bill's grave. What did you learn from that experience?
The town fathers are going to be all over me now. Yes, I have spent the night up there on Wild Bill's grave on a couple of occasions. On one occasion, I went up there with a paranormal investigator that had come into Deadwood and wanted to go up there to the cemetery in the middle of the night. So I got permission, and we went up there, and the lady set up a lot of cameras and recording equipment and things like that, and while she was doing that, I had a pair of divining rods, and I was asking yes and no questions next to the grave of James Butler Hickok. It is well known here in Deadwood and around the area and the country that I portray Wild Bill Hickok. And when I portray a character, I want to know that character as best I can. And so I started to ask questions of a yes and no nature of James Hickok, and he started to answer me. Basically, the answers were that he is still here. He is pleased with the portrayal that I am doing of him. He never was wanting to be a media star of any sort, although he ended up being what? And which eventually led to his death. He was very proud and pleased with the small town of Deadwood. He kept referring to Deadwood as his home, because I got the distinct feeling from him that the legend is that he died here, but he never did. He is still here. On a second occasion, I went up and I spent the night. I crawled over. They've got a big iron fence around the center of the grave, and you can't get rid of it. And I spent the evening up there, using the tombstone as my pillow up there. And it was an interesting evening because there were two of us. There was, well, it was quite a board meeting, let's put it that way. It was myself, who I am in life. It was my portrayal of James Butler Hickok, and it was James Butler Hickok. And it was an evening of a lot of, practical jokes, joking back and forth with each other, what it's like that we were doing. Not any kind of insightfulness about, well, you don't have that particular piece of history right, you've got it wrong. It was more of a familiarity amongst the three of us, which I really enjoyed. But now the city fathers are going to be all over me. they know
that
I
right.
got it. But
I have some connection there, and I don't know what it is to Deadwood, and maybe Kathleen can pick up on something. But as a kid, you know, in school you had to do numerous book reports, and the only one that sticks out in my mind is I did a book report on Wild Bill Hickok. When I turned 18, for some reason, or I thought I was a songwriter, and I wrote a song, and the song just happened to be named Aces and Eights. In 1987, I found myself diverted off the interstate and heading through Deadwood and Mount Moriah Cemetery. I actually went up there to the grave, and just different things seem to be. Well, I've done Civil War reenacting since 97, but yet I've always felt like I should be doing the Old West. Just a whole bunch of different things piled on top of each other just seems to point me toward Deadwood for some unknown reason. It's really weird and kind of freaks me out.
Well, I think the key to the answer to your question is your statement, things seem to pile one on top of the other. People have the idea, if they accept reincarnation as a reality, that you are born on X date, you die on Y date. You go somewhere, and then you are born on X2 date and die on Y2 date, etc. What if I were to posit some of the furthest hypotheses of quantum physics today? And an old statement from the 1940s by Professor Einstein. Time and space are the way we think, not the way things are. Time and space are there so that everything does not seem to happen to the same person at the same place at the same time. It is a convenient divining rod or a touchstone in order for you to know your soul better. What if time was more like the labyrinth or the round circles that are constantly going in on each other and leading to an inner point? What if reality is many layered and our spirits are in fact one with the Creator if we accept him, her, it, she, he, or not? If, as a matter of fact, we are living in parallel dimensions all at the same time, that idea or sentiment bleeds, affect you at various times, that leads you to go somewhere and to be at a point that we define as finite and fixed, at a time that we define as finite and fixed, yet actually you're going into your own vortex or portal, deep into your soul. You probably admire Mr. Hickok, what he stood for, the way he lived his life and his spirit. You probably admire or respect or are attracted to the spirit of Deadwood and the Pahasapa. Therefore, you find yourself at various times writing about it, reading about it, reenacting it, coming here, visiting a grave, etc. You are getting closer to the oneness of what we all are. And the various
levels of our existence. Think about your dreams, or what we call dreams. Are they any less real than the dream that it is what we call our daily waking existence? I don't know this, but I have a definite suspicion that we are living in multiple universes, different experiences, different lifetimes, all at what we call now, which always exists, never exists, and exists now.
You mentioned earlier that, Alan, you came into Deadwood and you went up to the cemeteries here, to our Mount Moriah. I don't know if you had a chance to go all the way to the top of Mount Moriah, where they have memorialized Seth and Martha Bullock. But it's not just what we are saying today in August of 2009, when they put that tombstone for Seth and Martha on their instructions. Seth died in 1919, and Martha died from this lifetime 20 years later in 1939. But on their tombstone up there, they instructed that all that's on that tombstone is their names, Seth and Martha Bullock. They put no dates of birth. They put no dates of death. Those were two people that were here in Deadwood for many, many years, from 1876 up until 1939. And they knew that there was something of the eternity of the spirit here. And they are the ones that are haunting that Bullock Hotel now. And it's an interesting testimony on that, not only as you were, when we started the show, we were talking about the tourist base and whatnot, but the people here in Deadwood, the Bullocks, for example, they knew the power that was here. And they knew that from a very close-up and personal way, as Kathleen and I have learned here in Deadwood also.
We also have someone here with us who is currently the bartender of Deadwood, in my opinion, and he is the bartender in Bully's Bar at the rear of the hotel casino known as the Historic Bullock Hotel. Bully's, of course, is a nickname that had to do with Seth Bullock's strong relationship with President Theodore Roosevelt, who, by the way, shows up in the pictures in the mirrors that we take all the time, and I've seen him walking through the main part of our casino. But don't take it from us. We have a gentleman we call Sir Anthony. He tends bar and makes the best Scooby snack in the world, and he's going to tell you about some of his experiences, and I'm not going to lead him on. I'm going to turn him over to you guys, and I'm going to let him speak for himself. Go ahead. Throw a question at him.
Well,
hi,
let's
Alan,
just start
Anthony.
Off. Yeah, so just tell us what goes on if I was to drive cross country and go there in search of spirits. What would I find?
Well, I don't know what you would find, but as for me, when I was working as a janitor 3.5 years back, I was at the bar. The bar was full, and a lot of people were sitting on the tables, and the bartender was on the other side of the bar. No one was in the bar. I saw the Johnny Walker Black Label bottle hit the Jim Beam and Jack Daniel's bottle and throw them down on the shelf, and the Johnny Walker Black Label bottle fall right on the floor and did not break. And there was not even an ounce of Johnny Walker Scotch in that bottle. Whereas the Jim Beam and Jack Daniels were full bottles. So
that was Sheriff Bullock's favorite drink, by the way.
Oh, that's crazy.
It sounds like he doesn't want anyone else moving in. Those are his drinks. He doesn't want anybody else's drinks on his bar.
Something like that, I think so, yes. But yep. Our bar patrons also take pictures in the back bar mirrors. And sometimes down in Seth's cellar, which is used now for private events, we get a picture in that mirror that looks like the bar scene in Star Wars on Mos Eisley. Except instead of having many tentacled aliens, we've got people in 1870s garb, from dancing girls, prospectors, miners, to attorneys. And it is so funny when we see them show up. Also, we notice that people feel that they're touched. They're sitting there waiting for Sir Anthony to serve them a drink, and someone's arm or shoulder comes between the patrons, between two and three stools from the left of the bar. So it's an interesting kind of upfront and personal kind of relationship. I got a gentleman of an elderly nature a glass of water at the beginning of my tour about a month ago, and just as he raised the glass of water to his lips, leaning heavily against the bar, he was jolted from behind. He moved forward 2 feet. The water flew above the gentleman's head and landed face down on the floor. I guess Mr. Bullock doesn't like the idea of people being served water at his bar.
No, this is
unless you're cutting the drinks. Oh, that's crazy. I can't wait to get back out there again.
It's a lot of fun. And we have a lot of activity now, I think, because we have a lot of visitors and because, my goodness, our spirits don't like 12 degrees below and 6 feet of snow any better than those of us still in physical body. And it's fun when the spring comes because we start to see the children. They show up in the photographs for the first time since the late fall. And then we start to have thefts of small blue objects from folks who are on the ghost tour. And we never find those items. They're of no material value. We get people with Chanel pocketbooks costing $2,000, and no one ever fools with them. But little plastic blue objects go fast. And the little girl who haunts the hotel, who died in the basement when it was a blacksmith shop turned into the smallpox quarantine ward for the prostitutes and their children, her name is Sarah. She starts filching items from people on the tour, tapping them on the back, kissing little children on the neck, showing up in the mirror. She's rather mischievous. There are stories about her moving items around, and I have also started to see plenty of telekinesis in recent months, and I've had my papers rise above the bar and float very gently to the edge and then slowly, slowly fall to the floor.
Wow. That's amazing. Incredible activity. Gosh, I probably wasn't a two-day drive. I'd probably be on my way right now.
Well, it's a fun place to come any time of the year. You get a more personal sort of tour and attention from the folks behind the bars and those of us who are tour directors, and you get some interesting activity also, especially around times such as the anniversaries of birth dates and death dates, opening of the hotel. When we celebrate the anniversary of the opening of the hotel in April, we have the funnest things. I do those tours. I've taken 15 men and women into a small single room, closed the door. It was a free tour, so they had to put up with it. It was very hot in there, even though I had had the thermostat set low and the blower on max. And if you put 15 people in a tiny room that is hot, what do you think is going to happen? Do you think that the temperature will go down 10 degrees and it will get so clear in there that it will be like being in an alpine meadow, then it starts to crackle, then two elderly ladies fall onto the bed, very red-faced, having an experience that normally we have with our dearest and most beloved, but they had it in public, and it was really fun.
That's funny, though, that you say that. I had a very similar experience just the other night. Al, you had left us already, and we were investigating into the third floor of our it's a mansion that I do tours and stuff in, and we were on the third floor part of that building, and, you know, there's no air conditioning. The building was built in the 1890s and still pretty much stands as it was. There's no air conditioning. We were in the high 80s that week, you know, real high humidity, so it was horrible up there. Me and two other people get into that room. We're sweating, you know, balls of sweat coming down off our forehead, and we start communicating. And it was funny, as we communicated and moving back and forth, asking questions of the spirit, I mean, we eventually all started to realize that this room was getting comfortable to sit in. You know, we were actually no longer sweating. And at one point, I actually said to the person next to me, I said, "Can you feel my arm? My arm was cold. I had goosebumps." And she went over and touched my arm, and she was like, "Oh, my God, you're freezing." Now, when we walked in this room, it was probably in the high 90s, and it was hot and sweaty and horrible. And by the time we left, and it was funny, we all kind of got the same impression that the spirit had left. It was like all of a sudden that calm, cool chillness of the room just disappeared, and that hot, sticky air just came right back in and filled it right back up, and we all pretty much said, well, whoever was just in here has just left. We might as well leave, too.
Well, if you were in a room...
And I want to thank you for what you left in the closet, too.
Well, it's really
fun.
Room,
I go up to this room, pitch dark, peek in the closet, and all I see is legs laying there.
Oh,
and they've got this Halloween scarecrow-like thing laying in the closet.
Oh, fun.
You know, and you stumble across that in the pitch darkness. Jeez.
That's funny.
Well, when you're here and we have electricity and air conditioning because of the renovation in the early 1990s, you can actually watch the thermostat go down on its own. It just turns itself backwards.
Wow, that's great. I would love to watch that. You know, that's something where I would go in with all my cameras and my own, you know, temperature gauges and just put a camera right on that waiting to capture it. And if I did, I'd probably be jumping around, you know, like a kid on Christmas.
It is. It's a gift whenever you show up, and that is why we have so many people, because they want results. They don't want to just talk about it. They want people to be able to see it. Now, I'm losing my voice. It's interesting. Whenever the spirits come, I often get congested, lose my voice, and sometimes I can't see. Sir Anthony, our bartender, has something to add as I try to clear my throat futilely.
Okay, Sir Anthony. Hi.
Hi, yeah. In fact, just 2.5 weeks back, I had three people at my bar, two people who were waiting to go for the ghost tour, and one guy from Chicago, and he never believed in ghosts. He thought it was just a tourist trap. Of course, I'm very skeptical. I just tell what I see. I just opened a Grey Goose bottle, just brand new. I opened it, I closed it, and I kept it on the shelf. And after about an hour, I was charging the same guest from Chicago for he bought some hot dogs. So I was charging him, and my back was towards the bar. And suddenly I heard a pop sound and then a click sound. Then I turned behind and I saw the Grey Goose bottle cork came off and fell right on the side of the bottle. It was facing top, right on the side of the bottle. And this guy from Chicago, he saw all this.
He saw the whole thing?
Yeah, he saw the whole thing. And he's saying, what happened? I just like normally, I mean, something must have happened. I just took the cork, put it back on, and I went to my normal duties. But I believe that gentleman from Chicago, he was like still baffled. He kept on drinking at my bar. I left at 10 o'clock, and after that, another guy was helping him out. Whole night, he talked with that guy. He said, I was just least interested in what happened. I just put the cock back on and started my normal duties. He started saying, that was fantastic. I mean, how did that happen? He was saying, I saw him put that bottle up there. I saw the cock was okay. And hello?
No, go ahead.
Yeah, he saw the cock come off and fall down right on the side of the bottle, and he couldn't believe his eyes.
So you're kind of getting, you're starting to actually kind of get used to them there. They, you know, you just kind of figure it's another little trick they're playing at you, and you just go on about your business.
Yeah, you know what? I'm very skeptical. What I see, I tell, and I have no explanation as to how this can happen. That's what my belief is. I'm not saying there's a ghost, but I leave it to each one of the persons who I tell this story to analyze it on his own and get to a conclusion that he thinks is possible. But I say there's no way possible that it, no way humanly possible or physically or by the laws of physics that any such thing can happen on its own.
Yeah, that is pretty, you know, you would think if it was blew off because of, you know, pressure built up, which, know, Grey Goose isn't carbonated. It's not like a, you know, a bottle of bubbly, you know, and there's no reason that should go popping off. And if it does, it would go flying up in the air and land, you know, God knows however many feet away.
Yeah, yeah. It would land somewhere else, not on the side of the bottle. That is imaginary. And it didn't jump off the bottle. It didn't fly off the bottle. It just popped off and fell down right on the side. This gentleman from Chicago, he saw it with his own eyes. And
that's amazing.
And it was a new bottle. I opened it and I shut it.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
And
weird.
And if I may, Josh, it's those kinds of paranormal activities there at the Bullock Hotel that happen on a daily basis. It is, you know, people are not seeing images walking down the halls every night and things like that, although that occurs there. It is these daily kind of events that take place there, and as Sir Anthony is saying, it becomes just commonplace there in the hotel.
Right.
The staff, the people that, you know, that eat breakfast in there every day, they all have their own kind of story of some sort or other that they have experienced there over the years. And there are other places here in Deadwood that also have those sorts of events. The old Franklin Hotel, which is up at the high end of our main street, there was a wall there that they were trying to do some renovation on, remodeling, and they couldn't get the stains off the wall. They kept reappearing. The day after the workmen cleaned them, they'd show back up again, sampling to try to figure out what it was that they could get used to take it off. Indicated that it was blood, and finally they just put a false wall up over that and left the stains behind there.
Right.
In the building that we are talking to you from, the old Fairmont Hotel, from the top floor where we are, all the way down into the basement where one of the Seth Bullocks, he was the first sheriff here in Deadwood and the United States Marshal, he had his jail downstairs here. There have been ashtrays that have flown across the room down there in the old tobacco shop. Images, full body images, have appeared down in the first floor, what is now known as the Oyster Bay here on Main Street. People have been seen walking down the hallways here. Women have been seen on the opening night on December 23rd, all dressed up in their fanciest turn-of-the-century kind of garb. These incidents go back to what I was talking about earlier about the land and what we were talking about, the land that we are on. I think that is so important. The Bullock Hotel is the most active and has developed a paranormal investigation there far more than any other property. But there are places up and down Main Street here that have reported very, very strange events.
After seeing the series Deadwood on HBO, you know, a lot of us that didn't know anything about it have gotten to know some of the other residents of Deadwood besides Wild Bill. To answer your question earlier, when I was in the cemetery, I didn't go up in the back because I didn't even know who Seth Bullock was at that time. I knew Wild Bill and I knew Calamity Jane, and that was it, and that was as far as I went. But who, I don't know, maybe I'm looking for kind of a rundown of who's who here. What spirits have been seen that some of us might know from the series Deadwood and recognize the names? What spirits have people run into in the town of Deadwood?
When I first moved here 4 years ago, I rented an apartment two doors down from the Bullock on the second floor above a novelty shop. I was almost blissfully unaware of Deadwood's history at the time, other than the Deadwood series. I walked out of my bedroom one morning and saw a lady in a coffin. I went to the Adams Museum and asked the staff to help me out and found the exact image that I had seen in a picture of Calamity Jane in her coffin. When I was working as a bartender in the Oyster Bay on the first floor of the building we are in now, the Fairmount Hotel, I was working the swing shift with another young lady, and at 1:45 we were debating whether we could close early. We are not supposed to lock the door until 2. I had a bad feeling about the night. It was snowing. It was very cold. Both myself and the other young lady had cars whose batteries had frozen. It was recently 25 degrees below zero. But I was unwilling to cross the owner and close early in case someone else needed to use the restroom or to buy something at the end. All of a sudden, the door blew open. That door has never blown open during gale force winds, and in walked a tall, dark-clad man. He came in and sat at the third bar stool from the cage, and both the young lady and myself, without speaking, knew what was going on, and then she said, "Who is that?" I questioned the man, and he gave me a number of odd answers. Of course, this person, we could see through him. We knew he was not real. He said, "Bar the door." I said, "Yes, this is a bar," and then you came in the door. He said, "Bar the door," and he slammed his fist on the bar. I could see through him. I ran behind the bar, behind the cash register, grabbed the keys, and locked all 5 doors. I was at the 5th door running to make sure that the 1st door was locked because the fear was overwhelming. She had collapsed on the floor in tears, and all of a sudden, a man who I know to be of an unsavory nature came up to the door and began to bang his way in, trying to get in, making faces, making threatening gestures. Now, 2 women alone could deal with him on the other side of a locked door an awful lot easier than on the other side of the locked door. So that was the first contact I had in a real way. And I found out later, the pictures, we compared them, the young lady and I, and found it to be, in fact, Sheriff Bullock. Sheriff Bullock has been seen by many employees in this place, and he helps them out. When money is missing, he directs them to where the money was misplaced in the cage. But Sheriff Bullock is by no means the only person who shows up in this place. As you know, 10 minutes ago, I could absolutely not speak. Sometimes, as I said, I can't see or can't hear. That is because some spirits are around me now. In fact, one lady who jumped out of the window on the 2nd floor of this particular establishment as a result of a love triangle. She is red-haired as I am, and I have seen her many times as I've worked nights in this place, and she is here. She is without name. She gives me a lot of different names. These women had no real name. Some of them didn't even have birth certificates. They were self-employed prostitutes as opposed to living in a crib or a large place where they were essentially bulldozed into doing what they were doing by the proprietor. These women were a bit independent. A lot of those women show up here. The brothels closed here in Deadwood in 1980. That's not 1880. It's 1980. I see people all the time. They have no names. They have no particular pedigree. But at our house alone, at 8:40 every summer evening, an owner of the house from the 1930s and 1940s, who was an undertaker, appears and stands at the very same place on our deck and looks out over Deadwood. In fact, when I thought that David was coming home and I went to open the door for him about 6 weeks ago, I heard his boots on the wooden steps in the deck. The dog went to the door, wagging her tail, waiting for David to come home. There was no one there.
Oh, boy.
No one there. Also, at that very moment, my computer went on the fritz, and it began to go round and round like the numbers that showed up on that movie, Pi. And the electromagnetics of the entire room changed. I couldn't hear, and I began to choke as I was doing 10 minutes ago. So there are many unlauded people who show up, Calamity Jane, Wild Bill. Wild Bill can be seen every now and again, often out in the back in the parking lot that is shared between the place we are in now and the next door place, which is where he died. People see all sorts of people in their homes, in their yards, garages, etc. They don't have any names. we do have a couple of mischievous workers from the blacksmith shop over in the basement of the Bullock Hotel, and every now and again they do mischief, such as poking people on the tour, scratching them, and we have a ghost cat and dog, and they don't have any names either. It's not all a star billing. Some people are just average people, but they're fun when you meet them.
Oh yeah, I imagine.
and I think that if there's any spillover, if there's any cross pollination, the characters of the two that we mentioned most prominently, James Hickok and Seth Bullock. Hickok, he was not liking at all the media starness that he got. He was a very quiet man. He liked people. He liked to joke with them, tell tall tales with them, but he didn't like the attention that he was given. He liked to be kind of left alone. Seth Bullock was of the same nature. He was all business. He was a very serious man. He probably was a very difficult man to be in close proximity with. His nickname was the Bishop because he was so stiff-collared, and he just would not put up with any kind of mischief at all. That's why his friendship with Teddy Roosevelt was so important to him. He was the only man that Teddy Roosevelt wanted with him when he got the Nobel Peace Prize. He was the man that was Teddy Roosevelt's personal bodyguard for many, many years. And finally, Roosevelt, because he was getting so much grief from the other people about who's this man from, this cowboy from Dakota that's walking around with you with a gun all the time, Teddy Roosevelt finally said, he's a United States Marshal. Those two, they show up here in times of distress. Seth has shown up and delivered many a message to Deadwood. You know, when they legalized gambling here in the early 1990s, there was a lot of concern about what kind of clientele would be attracted, what kind of business interests would be attracted here. And Deadwood took the warnings of Seth Bullock to heart, and it's a very upright, clean town. People get here and they get a little rambunctious because they think they're back in the old West, and that's fine, because we want people to have fun here in Deadwood. But those two characters, Seth Bullock, who was a founding father of this town and built the foundation for this town, and James Hickok, who has become the icon of Deadwood, they have a very quiet and peaceful nature about them, and they want things. They were both lawmen, extraordinary lawmen, and they abided by the law, and they expected everybody else to live up to their responsibilities.
Hickok went at it. The amount of lawmen that seemed to have been attracted to Deadwood. You know, he had Wyatt Earp coming through as well. Now, I've read two different things now. Was James Butler and Calamity Jane married or not?
No, they were not. I just
read something last week that they said it's been proven now that they were married.
No.
So you haven't proved it to me.
James Hickok had courted a lady for 4.5 years, Agnes Lake Thatcher. Her family was in the circus business. They had several large circuses that traveled around the country, and Hickok met Agnes at one of the performances. She refused to marry him because he was known as a gunslinger and a killer lawman. And he had his very last gunfight in October of 1871, the very last time he killed anyone. He courted Agnes for 4.5 years. She finally agreed to marry him on March 5th, 1876, and they were married in Cheyenne over in Wyoming Territory. Hickok met Calamity for the very first time on the wagon train that was coming up here from Cheyenne to Deadwood, and they stopped off at Fort Laramie, and Martha Jane Canary was in the guardhouse sobering up, and she got thrown off the fort, and she had to come up to Deadwood on the wagon train with Hickok, and that was the first time that they met. There was a woman at the turn of the century, 1910, 1912 or so, come down out of Montana. She claimed that she was the daughter of Calamity Jane and James Hickok. And when they started investigating the paper trail that she was basing this on, they were all forgeries. That was one of the latest ones. There is some discussion that Hickok may have been married before Agnes, but the knowledge of that and the records of that have been probably buried and destroyed by the Hickok family out of Illinois, because they got very involved with him because the lady purported was a Native American by the name of Indian Annie. There was some discussions, and there's a lot of historical fact that there may have been a relationship between those two, but nothing between Calamity and Hickok.
Now, if I remember my history right, Charlie Utter came with them from Fort Laramie too, right?
That is correct. Charlie had put the wagon train together and was bringing quite a party of miners and businessmen and gamblers and whatnot up here to Deadwood on that wagon train from Cheyenne. Charlie stayed here in the hills, in the northern hills and in Deadwood for many years. He started a freighting business, a mail delivery business, kind of a Pony Express business, and was a businessman here for several years. Eventually, he ended up down in Central America and died down in Central America. But both Charlie and his brother Steve, they were on that wagon train that came up here with and brought Calamity Jane and James Hickok here to Deadwood.
Yeah.
I think there's significant and credible evidence that, as a matter of fact, Indian Annie and James Butler Hickok conceived a child by the name of Willie, who may or may not have died at roughly the age of 14 in the county poorhouse in Kansas, where Indian Annie also died. There are newspaper accounts of the citizens of Ellsworth, I believe, saying that they thought that Mr. Hickok was an exemplary citizen, other than in his treatment of his wife, Annie, and his son, Willie. That she would have had to scrub floors in the Grand Central Hotel and tell fortunes to make a living. Eventually, they moved to the poorhouse. Young Willie supposedly died of diphtheria, and she died essentially of pneumonia and a variation of tuberculosis. Whether or not that's true, I think it's extremely likely. The research I've done into sort of the feminine relations side of Mr. Hickok, something that David hasn't really looked into that much, tells me that he was very comfortable with the fortune-telling Native American aspects of the young lady, Annie, because he became involved with a lady here in Deadwood by the name of Madame Henrico Livingstone. Of all the characters I portray, perhaps she is my favorite because she is the closest to me in that we are both fortune-tellers, clairvoyants, healers, etc. And she foretold Wild Bill's demise by reading his cards. And she had known him for some time throughout the cow towns of the West, and she was enamored of him, and she was trying to save him. I think that James was alternately repelled and fascinated by the occult and the ability to see into the future. He certainly exhibited it in his last written communication, which was to his wife, Agnes, wherein he said, "I think this is my last gold camp, and I see that I perhaps am going to swim to another shore. I hope that when I struggle onto the bank of that shore, I will be able to join with you again, but in another world." To me, that says that he knew. And having had experiences with ending up in the morgue with the toe tag and everything in this life, you know when you're going to go. And you are much more aware than you would think. It has happened to me 3 times. And you are very comfortable with how things are going once you've left the body, which is ravaged by disease or by recent serious injury. And I think that he became what I would consider almost absolute, meaning being in communication with all things, for several days prior to his taking the bullet in the back of the head. His letter certainly indicates that.
Yeah, they're saying that, you know, the letter definitely kind of hints off that he knew something was coming of a grave, you know, matter,
yes,
grave circumstance.
Yes,
definitely.
Yes,
definitely.
No question. No question about that. And you ought to go over to where his camp is, which is only about 3 blocks from where we sit right now, and see the images and the feelings that you have there, because that was where he was staying at the very end, and he was there for a good reason and had good visibility around. There were a lot of gold claims of a placer or surface nature right around the creeks there. There was fresh water to bathe in and drink, and he was located well.
Now, where he was sitting at the time he was shot, was he sit there by choice, or was that the only empty chair? Because I know he always sat with his back to the door or the wall, and this time he didn't do it. Did he do it by choice?
Well, that is a debate of history. I can relate to you exactly what transpired 133 years ago.
Well, I figured you've been having this conversation with him up at the grave. I figured if anybody knows the answer, you should.
it almost to the hour where we are speaking right now, right below us next door is where the assassination took place. And I call it an assassination because that's what it was. Jack McCall had been playing poker with Hickok and several others the night before. Hickok had beat McCall at the card table pretty bad, gave him $1 so that he could have breakfast the next morning. When Hickok arrived in the Nuttles and Mann Saloon, located on the 10th mining claim here in the district, it was known in 1876 as Nuttles and Mann Saloon. He went in there. There were 3 men in the back playing poker. One was Charlie Rich, was a gambler out of Cheyenne. Second one was Carl Mann, who was the co-owner of the saloon at the time. Third one was Captain William Massey, a retired Missouri riverboat captain. He was a gambler also. There was one empty seat at the table. Probably in the 1876, furniture was a very precious commodity here in the Gulch. There was probably barrels, tree stumps that they were using as their seats. There was one empty seat at the table. Charlie Rich was sitting up against the wall. Hickok had asked Rich if he could move into that seat. Rich had refused him. Not once, but refused him twice. Told him that he was just being paranoid. Sit down, nobody been in there, play poker. Conjecture is that it could have been a conspiracy. The conspiracy theory was brought up in the first trial. It was brought up in the second trial of Jack McCall. It was never pursued or proven. It was pursued on why Jack McCall killed Hickok. As I said, he was probably a hired assassin, hired by 2 men here in Deadwood at the lower end of Main Street that ran casinos and brothels and dance halls. Deadwood was a lawless town then. Everyone here was an outlaw because this was Indian territory and the federal government had forbidden any whites to be in here. They were all in here as outlaws. There was no law. And they thought Hickok was coming in to be the law.
I did.
He had given up his badge in 1871. He had started to lose his eyesight, perhaps because of the stage lamps when he was with the Buffalo Bill Cody Wild West show. When they arrested McCall, he had $100 worth of gold dust in his pocket. That was the payment for the assassination. He always claimed that it was a revenge killing, some cotton bowl story about how Hickok had killed his younger brother for stealing chickens. And Hickok had never done that. And all the recorded
gun battles of Hickok.
He had no younger brother.
And he had no younger brother named Elmer. And they figured that he was coming in here to be the law. They hired McCall, who had a chip on his shoulder anyway. McCall went in late in the afternoon in the Nuttles a Man's saloon, pulled out a revolver out of his belt, and about 5 feet away shot Hickok in the back of the head. Of course, the legend and the fact is that Hickok was holding in his hand the black ace of spades, the black ace of clubs, the black ace eight of clubs, and the black eight of spades. And that was always known then as the dead man's hand. It's interesting because when Hickok had his cards read by Madame Henrico just a few days before down here on the street, the card she pulled out was the eight of spades and told him, the ace, that would be you. And the eight of spades, and she says, that is infinity. Don't go back down to the 10th, the number 10, on the 10th mining claim, Nuttles a Man's saloon. Hickok did, and on the 2nd of August, late in the afternoon, he was killed right here on Main Street of Deadwood. He was buried originally in the old Ingleside Cemetery, and then in 1879, they moved his body up to Mount Moriah. But the conspiracy theory, I think that Nuttles a Man knew that if they had a saloon on Main Street of Deadwood where Wild Bill was killed, they would have a going business concern. And they did for many years until the place burned down in 1879. Did they have something to do with it? I don't know. I cannot answer that. Neither can James himself. He has suspicions. But he also suspects that it was the only way they knew they could ever kill him, was to shoot him in the back. And he wasn't going to be the law. He didn't trust his eyesight anymore. And they killed him. Interestingly, 2 weeks later, the middle of August of 76, we had a Methodist missionary here in Deadwood by the name of Preacher Smith. He was the only preacher man here at the time. And he came in, preached the gospel on Main Street. And one Sunday afternoon, he was riding out to do church services for the cowhands, the hay hands out on in Spearfish Valley. And he was ambushed and killed. They tried to blame it on the Lakota, who were on the warpath then. But it was, again, assassins who killed him. And so within 2 weeks, in the summer of 1876, August, they killed James Hickok because they thought he was going to be the law. And they killed the preacher man because they didn't want either law or religion here in Deadwood Gulch in the summer of 1876.
Wow. It's amazing. You know, nowadays, all the stories you hear, everything has a conspiracy theory behind it. And even back then, you know, a mysterious death. And they, you know, people were just as mistrusting and looking for better answers than what was given to them, you know, even then as they are now.
Right, and that's one of the problems with history, is trying to weed through it. And I think if you can get into the beings of the historical characters that you're working with, you can come up with some of the, you know, some very plausible answers for it. You know, you mentioned Wyatt Earp earlier. Wyatt was here. He was here from the fall of 1876 to the spring of 77. And he came up out of, he was a lawman out of Kansas, just as Hickok was. But he came up against Seth Bullock, who had been a lawman over in Montana, in Helena, over there on Last Chance Gulch and the gold strikes in Montana. And one of the things to understand at that time was the political machine of any locale was really run by the local sheriff back then. The sheriff ran the political machine. Bullock learned that over in Montana, and he ended up in the Montana Territorial Senate as a result of it, a young man, 24 years old. Earp learned it down in Dodge City. He came to Deadwood and confronted Seth Bullock, and Bullock told him to you know, just move on. I've got everything under control here, because he knew that he had control of the political operations here as well as the law operations. And what did Earp do? Not more than 4 years later, he ends up down in Tombstone in Arizona Territory at the OK Corral, and all the myths and the legends and the movies and the songs and everything else they write about the OK Corral, what it comes down to is that it was a political gunfight for the political control of Cochise County and Tombstone, that gold camp. Earp was involved trying to do that here in Deadwood. Bullock was involved with it in Montana. And down in Kansas, both Hickok and Earp knew what strings were being pulled. And that was, when you put that bit of history and knowledge over the legends and the myths of what was going on out here in the West at that time, it starts to make a lot of present-day sense, because now you can see where the rivalries were and the power struggles were. Yeah, it's always nice to have the gunfight at high noon on Main Street, but why is it going on? You know, was it a bunch of drunken cowboys down in the OK Corral, or was it a political battle? Was it a conspiracy theory that killed Hickok here? Perhaps it was, but it was a conspiracy theory that they didn't want law here at the time. So that's how we approach our living history here in Deadwood. A lot of it is, you know, we've got to go with the legends, because that's what people believe and understand through the media today. But we try to give that, we try to suspend that reality and get them right back and say, okay, here are the reasons why. Here is actually what happened, as best as we can put it together today.
And when you talk to the women, it's really interesting, because the women, other than, say, Calamity Jane or Mrs. Martha Bullock or perhaps Mrs. Agnes Lake Thatcher Hickok, when you start talking to the women who clean the toilets, the ones who wash the pans, the ones who wash the dirty underwear, that is very interesting, because my first confrontation with a spirit here in Deadwood was in my first summer here, 2005, when there was a restaurant in Miss Kitty's Casino called, Schnitzler's. It sold German food. Well, I understand the food was rather good, but I never got to eat there because it basically was evacuated when I got here, because the knives and the plates were flying. So they had heard about me, and I went in there with my bare feet and my glass of water, and there was a very angry woman there who had been treated rather badly by the cowboys here in Deadwood. She had been killed, decapitated, and then her head rolled down Main Street in front of Star and Bullock Hardware, which is now the Bullock Hotel. Well, she took it upon herself to talk to the present-day owners of the Bullock Hotel and warn them about some things that were going on there, because she didn't like misbehavior, because misbehavior was the reason she got herself killed and she was still on a watch here. And so talking to the folks behind the house, back of house as it were, can be just as interesting or more interesting than the figureheads and legends that we come to know so well. And those are the ones that choke me up, the ones who caused me to be struck blind and deaf. And then you get a little message, and believe it or not, it makes sense to the owners. It makes no sense to me. It's not a message for me. I'm simply the conduit. And I get some real fun ones, and pretty much 99.9% of the time, they're accurate, they're timely, and they're useful. There is our collaboration, or as Carlos Castaneda would say, validation by special consensus. Do you have several people having similar experiences or having experiences that match up in certain important ways that are separated from each other? They write down or they record their experience. The experiences are then compared by a neutral observer, and they're found to correlate. We can't do double-blind placebo scientific method. And anyway, as you know from physics and from Marshall McLuhan, you know, you are the media. The observed is very important in influencing the motion of the most simple photon or particle in physics. You can determine either its trajectory, its distance, or its mass and its location. You can't have both. You send out two photons to two sides of the universe, and the correlation between them is shocking. It leads one to understand that time and space are the way we think, not the way things are.
Very true. That's
well, we
very
have about
true.
7 minutes left here. You got any final questions, Josh? Or?
Oh, I bring one more thing up. You know, we were talking early on here, almost an hour ago now, it doesn't even seem it, about, you know, the rich native history and how far back that land goes. Do they ever have run-ins with natives, you know, native spirits, you know, and you know, besides just the Wild West spirits, you know, the spirits from 500, 600 years ago?
Well, actually, it's interesting that you would ask that now, because when the Unsolved Mysteries show was done in the early 90s, there was a ancestor, a relative of the Bullock family who was here in Deadwood, in Dorset, England, who was getting messages about this place he had never heard of called Deadwood. And he was getting it from a Native American guide called Singing Water. Now, up until recently, we had had no way of corroborating anything along those lines. But in the last week, we have gotten two pictures in the mirrors, one of a Native American girl and one of a Native American man. I have also had assistance from certain shamans and religious here in the Black Hills who have talked to me about what I am doing, because as you might or might not know, in Native American culture, speaking about the dead is verboten. If you have prepared anything of their funeral rites, it is a major, major social gaffe of deep significance. So I've been guided in that, and I do it with great respect, but yes, we do get native spirits every now and again. I can feel them around me. All we have to do is go to Bear Butte or to Devil's Tower, and it becomes as real as the paper that's probably in front of you now. They are very much alive. They believed in eternity. They planned their whole lives around eternity. Ho-ho-kum, a greeting among natives, meant it's a good day to die, because they knew that, as a matter of fact, we are the Grateful Dead, and when you pass through God's other door, you become fully alive, and you are known not as in a shadow, but completely. And they integrated that into their daily life, and they did not want spirits to be separated from each other, because they knew that the eternity to come and the placement of your spirit in that eternity was the important thing of life, not the minutiae that we get so involved with, the linear, time-based, space-based drama that we get so involved in every day. It's such a waste of time, but unfortunately necessary to keep the entity going. I mean, you have to shower, brush your teeth, pay your bills, take out your garbage. But think about your eternal spirit, the manna from heaven that keeps you in the eternal cosmological circle.
And
that is what is important.
And it's a living here with the native culture, even though you know, they still claim the Black Hills as their ancestral lands. Out here at Bear Butte, it is a state park now. We've reintroduced some buffalo out there. And the native cultures here still hold that mountain in reverence. There are still many ceremonies that go up there. And only outside of places like Nepal and Tibet have I seen as many prayer flags, the trees around the base, the trees going, following all the trails going up to the top of Bear Butte are full of prayer flags and ribbons and medicine pouches and tobacco pouches. The trees are heavy with them. You go walking up through there and it's just like you're walking through a park of flags. It's a very touching and moving place to go up to Bear Butte, because the native cultures here from the many reservations that surround the Black Hills, the Pine Ridge, the Rosebud, the Standing Rock, those people come here, they do their ceremonies, they pray up on top of Bear Butte, at the base of Bear Butte, they leave their offerings, and those offerings are there for eternity here. And we guard that very, very jealously here in the Black Hills.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's, you know, special sacred land up there, you know.
And if you know the myth of the turtle, the myth that has gone through the last 16,000 years of the Kali Yuga in Sanskrit, the age of evil or the dark age, we are coming to the end of it, obviously, in 2012. What will happen is determined by the spiritual elevation of every person. No person is here extra or by coincidence or accident. All of us must raise our consciousness to end this age in the very best possible way. And the turtle, the one that has been assumed to be the place that would rise up and survive anything that might come, you are talking to two people sitting in the third eye of the head of the turtle. That goes through creation myth all over the world, in all cultures, in all times, and in all religions. It's
well,
a very favorite place.
We got a couple minutes left here, so I want to thank both of you and Sir Anthony for coming on the show. Do you have any last minute parting words and website addresses or how we can sign up for a stay at the Bullock Hotel or a tour and all that good stuff?
Well, you can call the Bullock Hotel, Historic Bullock Properties. Call them directly and make a reservation. If you wish to have a tour, you may speak to the people at the front desk. If you would like a private extended psychic tour, you can contact us at our email address of krl324@yahoo.com or davidasoma@yahoo.com. You can see a little bit about us on the Deadwood Chamber of Commerce website under the Lone Stars of Deadwood. My last words would be absolute in your spirit, be absolute in your ethics, be absolute in your morality. Know that we are all one. And David, have you anything more to say after that one?
The only thing is that you, the eternity of your spirit here in the Pahasafa of Dakota is something to experience, and we invite everyone to try to make a pilgrimage of some sort to these Black Hills of Dakota and see what it is all about, not only the history, but the spirit of this place. It is the spirit of the Pahasafa that has gone on for centuries and eons, and we're just a small little fleck in time on it right now. And I think if you look at it from what Kathleen was talking about, the turtle, the aerial shots of the Black Hills, it is similar, very similar, to looking down on a massive turtle. And that is the Black Hills of Dakota, and that's where we are located, right, as she says, in the third eye at the head of the turtle.
Amazing.
Very good. I want to thank you guys for coming on. And,
thank you for having us.
Thank you.
I know I'm going to stay in touch with you because, you know, I've been playing around in my spare time with Haunted America TV, and I know we've got to put some type of webcast together from the Bullock Hotel or something, because I just know it would be great. So
I'm sure it would.
We'll definitely stay in touch with you there and get you back on here again.
And watch for us on Paranormal State.
Absolutely, we
will do that.
Yes.
All right. Thanks a lot. We look forward.
Thank you,
to
Alan. Thank you, Josh.
Thank you.
All right, we got about 30 seconds here, so thank you both of you for coming on, and we'll be in touch with you.
Wonderful. Bless you.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye
now.
Now.
Bye.
Bye.
And that was David Soma and Kathleen Lane from Deadwood, South Dakota. Reenactors and living historians, ghost tour operators, you name it, psychics, intuitives, all kinds of things. We got about 50 seconds here, Josh. Anything you want to say for us?
No, that was great. I could have stayed on with another hour for them. That was a very great interview. Hope everybody enjoyed it, and we'll hear you again, or you'll hear us again next week.
Definitely got to get him back on here. Next week, Paul Rademacher, Executive Director of the Monroe Institute. We're going to talk hemisync
and how to make you a psychic.
That's what I need.
Join us. Yeah. Next Sunday, 7 p.m. right here. Be here.